The situation in Flint, Michigan has refocused the nation on lead poisoning. But we've known for a long time that kids with lead in their blood
did substantially worse on neurological tests and IQ tests and behavioral tests.
I'm Kara Holsoppel. This week on the Allegheny Front, the complicated legacy of lead in our homes. And many people religiously check the sell-by dates on milk cartons, but often don't know.
They're not intended to communicate safety.
A new technology could help us stop dumping perfectly good milk. Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Is fracking occurring too close to the places where people live and work? According to a new study of setbacks in Pennsylvania and two other states, the answer is yes. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports.
A group of researchers from Pitt and West Virginia University looked at health data and environmental regulations in Pennsylvania, Colorado, and Texas. They found that minimum setbacks from oil and gas wells in these three states were too close to homes, businesses, and schools. They say that leaves residents vulnerable to explosions from well blowouts and air pollution generated at wells. Pennsylvania's minimum setback is 500 feet. At a press conference held outside the Pittsburgh office of the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, study lead author Marcia Haley of the University of Pittsburgh said that's not far enough.
500 feet we know is not sufficient. Unfortunately, there is no defined safe setback distance. Maryland says 2,000 feet. I'd probably say that's a good minimum distance.
A DEP spokesman said the agency is reviewing the study. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
If your home was built before 1978, there are likely layers of lead paint on the walls. Pennsylvania ranks fourth in the nation for most homes built before then. Decades after lead paint was banned, Keystone Crossroads' Eleanor Klibanoff says we're still asking the same question. Whose job is it to clean up the mess?
When David Rosner was a kid, he'd go into his grandfather's garage and mix up cans of paint.
I can still remember, you know, just sticking a stick in it to mix it up and hitting halfway down a solid mass of hard stuff, and that was lead.
Rosner, a professor of public health at Columbia University and the author of the book Lead Wars, now knows the dangers contained in that can of paint. Exposure to lead through dust and chipping paint can cause permanent developmental delays in children under the age of six.
It became apparent in the 1970s. Children who had lead in their blood did substantially worse on various kinds of neurological tests and IQ tests and behavioral tests, and also did worse in school.
Lead was banned in paint in 1978. 70% of Pennsylvania's current housing stock was already built by then. And while lead poisoning has declined statewide, in 2014, there were still over 13,000 children with elevated blood lead levels. And that's only testing 14% of children in the state. We've had 40 years to remove or permanently encapsulate all that lead paint, but that hasn't happened. Vicki Kistler, the director of the Allentown Bureau of Health, says many homeowners can't afford the remediation, which can cost thousands of dollars.
We have had landlords shutter up the building. The lead abatement could actually be more costly than the value of the property. We have had homeowners sell their home. They can't do the abatement, and then they have to disclose that it has lead, so it would be difficult to resell it.
Over the years, Pennsylvania has helped finance remediation through a hodgepodge of federal grants. But that money recently dried up. The EPA stopped providing grants in 2010. HUD did not renew a grant the state had received since 2000. And when Pennsylvania changed how they applied to the CDC, they lost that funding as well. Individual cities still receive some federal grant funding. The state now puts $2 million towards the lead issue each year, according to Health Secretary Karen Murphy.
We have a hotline. People are able to call in and we provide electronic materials or counseling. We also have community health nurses. When they get the reported elevated lead levels, they begin case management with children. It is also to really educate people on how the elevated lead levels occur.
Right now, state funding focuses on education, not remediation. So Kistler from the Allentown Health Bureau says unless a child's lead levels are extreme, interim solutions are what they're able to offer.
So we actually deliver them cleaning supplies. We tell the parent to wash the child's hands more frequently, wash the toys, keep the floors and windowsills clean, and we work with that family and the pediatrician to try to implement that plan of action and then retest and see if the levels go down.
That can work, but it also means that lead paint remains on the walls until the next family moves in and starts the process over again. It's not surprising we've gone 40 years and still have cases of lead poisoning across the state. But Kistler says
there isn't enough money in the world to remove all the lead that we have in our communities.
Remember David Rosner, the guy who used to mix paint in his grandfather's garage? He says society's been paying the bill for 40 years.
If the state's setting up programs, if cities are setting up programs, if the federal government has programs, children are paying the price, if schools are being forced to get special ed teachers, if everyone's paying for the cost of what this industry did, except the industry itself.
Rosner has testified in lawsuits against paint companies like Dutch Boy, ConAgra, and Sherwin-Williams. In 2013, they were ordered to pay California cities $1.1 billion towards lead remediation. The paint companies appealed the decision, but if the industry ends up paying, that would set a precedent for other states to try the same. Eleanor Klibanoff, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media collaboration focusing on Pennsylvania cities, their problems, and potential solutions. So we know lead is really bad for kids, but why aren't more kids tested for lead? To help answer this question, I turn to Dr. Karen Hacker. She's been the director of the Allegheny County Health Department for 2.5 years and is outspoken on the issue of lead and children. She recently penned an op-ed in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and I spoke with her at her office in downtown Pittsburgh about her concerns.
Why are children especially vulnerable to lead exposure?
So this has to do with the developing brain and the impact on lead on the developing brain. And we know that having early exposure to high levels of lead can lead to learning and behavioral problems. By the time you're 5 or 6, it's in a different shape. Not that you still don't have some brain development, but you're just not impacted in the same way. Technically, we would like to see lead testing twice before 24 months. So we'd like to see one at 9 to 12 months and one at 24 months.
But this is not necessarily something that doctors would do as a regular battery of tests.
You know, I think some do and some don't. It's hard for us to really get a handle on the volume. We definitely know that lead testing has increased over the years, and that's a good thing. But also should remember that lead testing is not done in the office. There's not a rapid lead test. And so as a result, you have to send someone to a laboratory to have it done. And we also believe that there may be recommendations that aren't necessarily followed through on because someone doesn't actually go to get the lead test.
Is there any level of lead in the blood that's safe?
So at this point in time, according to the CDC, there is no safe blood lead level. And there was a time when we were particularly concerned over a certain level. There are now levels where we might be monitoring someone, like for example, over 5, where we might monitor someone to see if it's going up or down. But in general, we don't consider it safe to have lead in your blood.
When you say over 5, what does that mean?
So that's 5 micrograms of lead per deciliter of blood. And there was a time when the CDC generally thought that anything over 10 was a level of concern. Now they're asking overall to be concerned about anyone who's over 5, at least to do that watchful waiting process.
Yeah, you wrote in your op-ed piece that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recently changed its recommendations about lead levels and the threshold that's considered an elevated level. How does that impact getting more kids tested for lead?
You know, that's an interesting question because I'm not sure it does, because the resources that we've had here at the health department to be able to follow children are very limited. Most of those dollars come from the federal government, and over time there has been a diminution of that. When it comes to pediatricians, you may know that in Pennsylvania, they're not required to do lead testing. It's recommended, certainly for Medicaid children, but it's not required. And I think that as those changes have been made, we certainly would like to encourage more testing.
Why isn't there mandatory statewide testing of lead in children in Pennsylvania? Why isn't this already happening? And is Pennsylvania behind the curve?
Well, there's only a few states that have actually gone online mandating lead testing. In terms of Pennsylvania, as I said, it's been recommended, particularly in children in low-income neighborhoods. Medicaid has been the proxy for that. Why has it not occurred is a little hard for me as a fairly recent newcomer to the state, but I do think that we're missing the ball, and I think it would make sense, given what we know about lead, the damage that it can do to a child's brain, I think we should be investing more resources in really encouraging all children to be tested.
In the absence of adequate funding for lead testing, what can be done to move the needle on this problem?
So I think the first and foremost thing has been that there was a much better in the past communication to the public about the dangers of lead. I think when lead testing increased and our lead overall has gone down, our rates of childhood lead poisoning have definitely decreased. I think like many public health issues, you take your foot off the pedal and you move on to other things that are more important. I think with the situation that's gone on in Flint, Michigan, it's really raised the question about lead over again. It's put it on the front page. Clearly, in Flint, they're talking much more about the water, but let's not forget that we still have problems in our housing stock.
Has what's happened in Flint and the increased attention on lead changed your priorities?
We've been talking about this literally since I've gotten here, but I think it has made me revisit the problem. And the other thing that's happened simultaneously is the shifts in the federal dollars that we've been getting. So we've had resources from the federal government to address lead. They have been shifting and changing away from case management, for example. But the most recent shift to the grant that we received that was providing the resources has actually shifted completely away from lead to injury prevention. And I think that really made us go, we cannot stop doing this work, and we've got to either figure out how to absorb it internally or look for new resources.
It's almost like the government's been caught out. This thing kind of blew up in Flint, and now everyone's asking, why aren't the dollars there?
Right. So I felt it was time to really make a point about the fact that, you know, you want, I think one of the challenges with public health is that we're somewhat invisible until there's a crisis. And then there's a crisis and we never have the resources what we really need to be able to prevent that crisis.
So what are you going to do?
Well, our plan at this point is our housing inspectors are being trained in the lead inspection kinds of strategies, and we are also looking at shifting some of our positions, particularly positions that someone may have retired from, to determine whether we can utilize them for lead inspection.
Dr. Karen Hacker is director of the Allegheny County Health Department. We have a lot more on lead, an explainer about lead in our water, and more on the health impacts of lead on kids. That's all at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. If there's a container of milk in your fridge and the sell-by date was yesterday, what do you do?
I automatically dump it. I won't even taste it.
That's what a lot of us do. But some are saying we should be crying over that spilled milk. It's a waste of resources. Later on the Allegheny Front, new technology could help us reform our bad habit. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Reed Frazier of the Allegheny Front. You know what I like about kids? They are curious. They want to know why things are the way they are, and if things are the way everyone says they are. Well, we at the Allegheny Front want you to be more like kids and ask us stuff you've always wanted to know. We're doing this thing called Citizen Q, where you ask the questions and we find out the answers. Questions like, does our recycling actually get, you know, recycled?
Is it just somehow all just going into the garbage?
We promise we'll find out the answers, and we'll put it all on the air. So send us your questions. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, or email us, info@AlleghenyFront.org.
Pennsylvania's natural gas industry is pushing ahead with its plans to build tens of thousands of miles of new pipelines. Pipeline companies are increasingly using eminent domain to build on private land. State Impact Pennsylvania's John Hurdle reports on one landowner's loss to the industry.
Chainsaws roared and heavily armed U.S. Marshals stood guard in a remote corner of Susquehanna County as workers cleared trees. It's the first step toward building a new interstate pipeline. The property owners had fought for years to save their maple syrup trees, but they lost a battle over eminent domain with the pipeline company. Megan Holleran's family has owned the land for three generations.
Whether you're pro-pipeline, anti-pipeline, pro-gas, anti-gas, it doesn't really matter. You should be terrified by this situation. A company came in here and to make a profit is able to steal our land from us.
Holleran says their land is not for sale. A spokesman for the Williams Company says transporting the cheaper Marcellus gas to New York is in the public interest. John Hurdle, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
There's more bad news for maple trees. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports rising temperatures due to climate change could eventually tap out the northeastern maple syrup industry.
Jason Blotcher's livelihood each year largely depends on the weather in February and March. He's the third generation in his family to run Milroy Maple Farms in Somerset County on Pennsylvania's southern border, just a few miles from Maryland.
You can't outguess Mother Nature, and she controls everything in this business.
It takes warm days and cold nights to get sap flowing through a sugar maple. They start drilling tap holes in the trees when daytime temperatures get in the 40s and nights are still below freezing. When Blotcher was a kid, they would tap in late February and early March, but he says that's changed in the past 10 years. Now they usually tap earlier, as much as a month earlier, and the timing is more erratic. Like most producers, Blotcher remembers the winter of 2012 when there was a thick layer of snow in his maple forest. And then, right as syruping was starting, temperatures shot up into the 80s. It was the warmest March on record.
So we went from fighting our way through 3 or 4 feet of snow in anticipation of a very good season because of that heavy snowpack to one of our poorest seasons we have on record because we had such a drastic change in the weather from cold, deep snow to too warm in that, you know, in a matter of 2 weeks to 3 weeks, it ruined our season.
Milroy Farms wasn't alone. U.S. syrup production was down as much as 40% in 2012. Erratic years like that aren't a surprise to Dave Cleaves. He's the climate change advisor at the U.S. Forest Service, which means he's often the bearer of bad news.
God, in this job I'm in, and people like this, they hate to see me coming, you know. They run like hell.
About 15 years ago, the Forest Service published what's called the Climate Change Tree Atlas, and what it found didn't look good for sugar maples in the Northeast.
We will see it gradually disappear or become less prominent.
Cleve says southern Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Maryland are on the southern edge of large-scale maple syrup production. He says as the climate changes, they're the first places that will have troubles with maple trees.
Because other more aggressive and adapted southern species that are always there, ready to take off and regenerate.
Milroy Farms owner Jason Blotcher says his maple grove grows along Mount Davis, the highest point in Pennsylvania, which gives trees the colder temperatures they like. So he doesn't get too worked up about climate change.
Oh, you hear about that all the time, you know, and the global warming. But I think that sugar maple is a very hardy tree and very adaptable. So I think under slight changes and so forth, it'll adapt.
And some of the top maple syrup researchers in Vermont and New York agree with him. Temperatures in the Northeast already have risen an average of 2 degrees Fahrenheit since 1970. And they say maple syrup production is going gangbusters. Blotcher is like most producers these days. He uses vacuum tubing to pull sap from the maple trees. This, coupled with other technologies, allows him to double production in half the time it took his parents. Michael Farrell is a maple syrup expert at Cornell University, and he runs a sugar bush in northern New York. In his book, The Sugarmaker's Companion, he says newer forest models, which take factors other than climate into account, show that things don't look as bad as the Forest Service predictions. Farrell says his own PhD research looking at maple trees in the forest mix backs that up.
We're not getting replaced by oaks and hickories up here in the Northeast. It's very unlikely that that's going to happen. And, you know, the foresters down in the mid-Atlantic, Midwest, where there's a lot of oak and hickory, you know, they're concerned that they're not getting the regeneration of oak and hickory. And they consider, a lot of them consider sugar and red maple invasive species down there.
But that's not what the Forest Service is seeing in the long term, 85 years from now, in the time frame of a tree's life. Dave Cleave says maple producers and researchers may be experiencing good times now. Trees aren't falling over and dying. But Forest Service studies that look at changes in the woodlands every few years don't find many maple saplings in the Northeast.
When they actually get down on the ground and count the seedlings by species, then they get an idea of, well, what is this future forest likely to look like? Because we're looking at the babies here.
Cornell researcher Michael Farrell says the biggest danger to young sugar maples is deer, which can eat the saplings. And syrup producers like Jason Blotcher are more concerned about invasive insects like the Asian longhorn beetle than warming temperatures. But the Forest Service's Dave Cleave says problems like these are intertwined with climate change.
It's not just the changing climate itself that impacts. It works through these stressors that are already there. Say it's moisture stress on the forest if it gets too dry, or if it gets wetter and moister and that's more conducive to insect and disease proliferation, then it's working through insect and disease.
At Milroy Farms, Jason Blotcher says there's nothing he can do about global warming, so he doesn't worry about it. But some forest researchers go so far as to call the maple tree a poster child for climate change in the Northeast because they say it's a resilient tree that might not make it unless efforts to cut greenhouse gases take root. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
We first aired that story in 2014, and so we called up Jason Blotcher, the maple farmer, for an update. He says all of his trees are tapped, and if the weather holds with warm days and cold nights, it'll be a good season.
First you get the buckets ready, clean the pans and gather firewood.
Late in the winter,
it's maple syrup time. You need warm and sunny days, but still a cold and freezing nighttime.
For just a few weeks,
it's maple syrup time.
When you look at pictures of those happy cows on the milk container, there's currently no way to know what they're eating. Ohio dairy producer Warren Taylor is among those trying to change that. He wants it very clear to consumers when cows eat corn and other feed that's genetically modified.
We have a right to know the process. We have a right to support the processes by which our food is produced, grown, and make our own judgment, thank you, about whether or not we support those processes or not.
I'm Julie Grant. Join us next week on the Allegheny Front as we delve into the heated debate over labeling of GMO milk and other foods.
Finally, we have a story this week about labels, more specifically, those expiration and sell-by dates. Turns out relying on these dates contributes to a lot of food waste, using up fresh water and energy, not to mention landfill space. Take milk, for example. I stopped by a busy grocery store on a Saturday morning, where I met Lauren Wallace, shopping for milk.
I look for the cheapest one and I always get the fat-free.
And she's inspecting quarts from the back of the cooler for the latest sell-by date. She trusts it. And when the milk in her fridge hangs around beyond that date,
I automatically dump it. I won't even taste it.
She's not alone.
Basically, around 90% of people throw food away when that date arrives, either always or most of the time or occasionally.
Emily Broadlieb is director of the Harvard Law School Food Law and Policy Clinic. She says what most people don't know is those sell-by dates have no standard meaning. They vary by state and even by company.
They're a guess by the manufacturer when they think the food will not taste as good or not be at its top quality. They're not intended to communicate safety.
You heard her. A guess. Pennsylvania is one of the strictest states when it comes to sell-by dates on milk. It has to be within 17 days after it's been pasteurized. It can't be sold after that, so it's either given or thrown away. This isn't about safety. The Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture says it's a quality issue. So what if there were a more accurate way to tell if milk is fresh inside the container?
This was a pure discovery. We weren't looking for this.
Greg Kenning is a physics professor at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. He and some of his students were just minding their own business, experimenting in the lab.
What I really wanted to make was what was called a super spin glass.
Don't panic. For those of us who aren't physicists, all you need to know is they were working with two elements. Remember your periodic table? Kenning embedded magnetic nanoparticles of the metal cobalt into the semi-metal, antimony.
1 nanometer usually is about 3 atoms wide.
The elements changed with time. Kenning increased the temperature and noticed something really interesting. Decay of their magnetic and electronic properties. Eureka.
The decay properties were very similar to the decay properties of food.
Now Kenning and his students are cranking out samples to learn more.
It's a lot of manual labor. You know, people think science is, oh, you know, it's like turning the television on. It's not.
Well, for Kenning, it's like turning an electron beam evaporator. We're in his lab, standing in front of the thing. It's like a big bell jar. Kenning twists the knob so that inside the cylinder, a little square brick of antimony is placed into the path of a gun that drives electrons over it.
It just heats up the surface of the metal, and so it's only the metal that evaporates.
It rises and beads up on a silicon chip, forming a thin layer. Kenning and his students do this over and over, creating multiple layers of the metals. These little samples, films of metal, like ultra-thin aluminum foil, could one day live in a label on a milk carton, mirroring how the milk inside is aging. Kenning's working with MIT to combine his samples with RFID, or radio frequency identification.
Easy passes are RFID.
Some stores like Walmart are already using this technology to track their inventory. Radio waves read electronically stored information on a tag.
So the idea is that you would come in to buy your quart of milk, and instead of looking at the dates for the freshness, your cell phone would tell you what the freshest milk was in the whole system. And you'd have a scanner in your fridge. Your fridge would tell you when it's going to expire.
Kenning thinks that the labels could be made for pennies apiece, but that the information could be invaluable to customers. He says it could help keep the supply chain honest, because it would be easier to tell if the milk has been left out or improperly refrigerated on its way to the store. And of course, it might also reduce waste.
Because if you know your milk is, or your meat is going to, it's got a day, day and a half, and you're getting an update on it, you go, okay, we got to use that meat today, as opposed to leave it for 2 days and throw it away.
Once Kenning and his team have milk nailed down, they'll move on to sensors for other types of food, fine-tuning their samples to track different rates of decay. He says his milk sensors could appear in a grocery store near you within a couple of years. Until then, you'll have to use the sniff test to see if that milk is still good enough for your cereal. Now, if you've never seen an electron beam evaporator in action, geek out at our website. We posted a video about nanoparticles and food labels there. That's at AlleghenyFront.org. I'm Kara Holsapple. Thanks for listening to The Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer. Join us again here next time, or find us online. On Twitter, we're at Allegheny Front.
State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy. Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports coverage of energy and conservation.